Okay. Thank you everyone for being here. This is a very exciting and important conversation we're about to have on COVID-19 and environmental law and policy. My name is Richard Ray. I am a co-director of the UCLA Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy, and this is a one of a series of events that we are putting together via Zoom to promote discussion of important issues in law and science, technology, and particularly with regard to COVID. We're co-sponsoring this event with the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. I'm thrilled to have with us here for discussion two names that I think everyone in this gathering two names that everyone I think in this gathering knows very well. And so the first is Ann Carlson, a UCLA Law School professor and also co-director of the Emmett Institute. And William Boyd, yet another UCLA Law School professor and professor of the UCLA Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. Thank you guys so much for joining me to have this conversation today. I look forward to learning so much from this conversation because while I'm interested in this topic and have a lot of questions, I don't have a lot of expertise, but I know that both of you have that in spades, so thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I thought the first big set of questions I wanted to ask you both about had to do with the immediate environmental effects of the pandemic, and then we can move on to regulatory responses and what we think about those, and also then finally wrap up with discussion of broader lessons, maybe for climate change or other forms of environmental regulation that we can take from our COVID experience, at least as we've learned about it so far. And then at the end of the session, I'm going to make sure to invite some questions from our large and growing audience, particularly from students, but also from other members of our group of wonderful attendees today. So let me kick it off there. Do either of you want to speak briefly about how COVID has already changed and changed the environment?
Anne, do you want to go first? Go ahead.
Sure, I'm happy to say a few words. Thank you, everyone. What a great audience. It's fun to see not only current students, but I saw on the RSVP list a ton of former students. Let's see, a childhood friend of my son's, the son of a college boyfriend. So nice to have you all here, and some of our very, very distinguished Emmett Institute board members. So thank you for joining us. I first just want to say that I hope everybody is doing okay under very, very difficult circumstances. There are not very many bright sort of observations we can make about the COVID pandemic right now. It's a scary time, and the economic fallout, I think, is really devastating for many, many people. I know people are hungry, people are out of work, they're frightened, and I think it's important to acknowledge all of that. With that said, I just want to say a little bit, just as an overview, and echo some of the things that Richard said. Let me just start by saying there are some immediate environmental consequences of the pandemic. The most obvious one for me is air pollution, and we can talk more about that. Another is the appearance of wildlife in urban settings. My daughter the other day was walking our dog, and a mother and two ducklings walked by on a what's regularly a busy city street. It's a great picture many of you have probably seen of a coyote on Michigan Avenue near the Water Tower in Chicago, lions sleeping in the roads in South Africa, and so forth. And so it's just kind of a marvel to watch what happens when human activity slows down so much. But the other thing I want to say is that as terrible a time as this is, these little peeks at the way in which the environment changes when human activity slows down do, I think, offer an interesting opportunity for us to think about what that might mean as the world begins to return to normal, although I think returning to normal is going to be a very long and slow process. And also what the economic fallout might mean for how we think about climate policy going forward, both for better and for worse. There are going to be some tough consequences. So I'll stop there and let William say a few words, and then we can get into more detail.
I'll just say a few things. I want to echo all of Anne's comments too, in terms of thanks to Richard and to his new institute, to the Emmett Institute, to all the supporters of the Emmett Institute, to all the students and everyone else who has joined. It's great to see some familiar faces on the Zoom, and I hope that we can all get together in person soon. I hope everyone is safe. Anne, I thought you were going to say a little bit about air quality in Los Angeles, and I hope we can circle back to that because I know that is your passion. I'll just say a couple of things about CO2 emissions, and then maybe a little bit about deforestation globally, which is another thing that I work quite a bit on. So I'm sure a lot of people have read that emissions globally are down in 2020 quite significantly right now, and are expected to be down for the whole of 2020 compared to 2019, but maybe not by as much as some people expect, right? So current forecast suggests a reduction in global CO2 emissions of around 5.5% for 2020. There were huge emissions reductions in China in February, 25% reductions in the United States between mid-March and mid-April, 10 to 15%. The biggest declines obviously have been in transportation, which is about 20% of global emissions. Other sources of emissions, power sector, agriculture, industry, have not seen the same level of emissions reductions. And of course, the estimates of the total declines that we expect to see for 2020 will depend on how long the shutdowns last and how quickly we get back to various activities like driving, whether there are durable changes in behavior or anything like that. But just for some perspective on this, the reductions in greenhouse gases that we expect to see for 2020, 5.5%, are still less than the 7.5% reductions we need to see every year starting now if we want to have a chance of keeping warming under 1.5 degrees Celsius. And so I think the bottom line here is that if we don't use this crisis to make progress on climate change, we are in big trouble. Very briefly, I'll just say one more thing. There's obviously lots of interesting things happening with environmental quality here in the United States during the pandemic and during the shutdown. In the Amazon, in Brazil in particular, it looks like the rate of deforestation is actually going up quite significantly, in part because of the lack of enforcement, it seems, which is stemming from a combination of factors, but in part because local and state governments are really not able to focus on enforcement and are shifting resources to the pandemic as they should. And so I think it's worth remembering that globally, we have a lot of other problems and challenges that we need to be focused on. It looks like right now that deforestation rates in Brazil in particular are up, by 200-250% in March of 2020 compared to March of 2019. It's too early to tell how long that will last, but we are also looking at a pretty serious fire season because of a drought in the Western Amazon. And so when you put all of that together and look at the possibility of an extreme fire season in the Amazon and in other parts of the tropics, that obviously could amplify a lot of the vulnerabilities to stress and mortality associated with the pandemic. So I'll stop there and turn it back over to Richard, and I know we'll get more into a bunch of this stuff as we go.
Well, I want to, Anna, speak to, specifically to LA air quality changes, but I can't resist following up on one thing you said in the midst of that, Will, and I thought it was really interesting that you compared the reduction in emissions that's occurred at least so far, and I guess you're projecting forward because of COVID stay-at-home orders, I assume is the predominant driver of that change, and you're saying that you know, as kind of a benchmark for assessing the emission reductions that would be desired to achieve certain warming changes or warming reductions. And could you say a little bit more about where the remaining emissions are coming from, and also about maybe more about the scale? In other words, if the emission reductions that happen because of COVID is insufficient, what's the magnitude or order of magnitude of additional change that would be required?
So sure. The first thing I'll say, obviously, is that a pandemic is a terrible way to try to reduce emissions. And I think everybody recognizes that. But I was just trying to give people a sense of the scale of the reductions that we can expect to see for 2020. And so if the forecasts that we've seen so far are roughly accurate, we're looking at a reduction in 2020 of roughly 5.5%, as I said, compared to 2019. And this may be the sort of all time, 2019 may be the peak of global emissions, and we may be now sort of moving down the curve. But obviously, you know, if transportation is the bulk of the reductions, that is, the bulk of the reductions we've seen have been because of declines in transportation. Transportation is only 20% of global emissions. There are a lot of other sources out there that have been sort of obviously diminished to some extent, but not by the same amount or haven't fallen off as much as transportation. And as the economy picks back up, I think the expectation is that transportation emissions will bounce back, and other economic activity and drivers of emissions in the economy will also bounce back up. The point, though, I think, is that even with the dramatic reduction that we've seen from the shutdowns, right, we're still not where we need to be if we want to hit a target of 1.5 degrees. We're really not where we need to be if we want to hit a target of 2 degrees either. And so I think this shows the magnitude of the challenge before us and the need to really decarbonize as quickly as we can. I think there are big questions about decarbonization that look different in different places, obviously. And so in the United States, in my view, it's all about electrification in the power sector and then electrifying transportation and other sectors. But in other places, as I was trying to indicate, you know, deforestation and land use is a big source of emissions. And so there's a whole different set of challenges there that I think are in some ways harder and less tractable maybe than they are here in the United States. I don't know if Anne wants to add anything to that as well.
Yeah, I would just add a couple of things. Just one note from our colleague, Alex Wong, who blogged on Legal Planet yesterday or the day before. We have, just a little shout out to Legal Planet. The Emmett Institute faculty and staff have been blogging all week for Earth Day and Earth Week, and the topics are all related to the pandemic and then the environment. And so if you want to read in depth about some issues that we're not going to have a chance to cover today, please go look. One of them is Alex's blog on China and the environment. And China is ramping up the permitting of coal-fired power plants during this period. So even if they're not up and running right now, when we're going to project forward about global emissions, that is not a good sign. The other thing I would say about transportation, which is also related to the air pollution question about Los Angeles, is that we've seen a huge decline in passenger transportation, you know, typically, you know, driving to school or work or what have you. We've not seen much of a decline in truck traffic, and that's including in Los Angeles. That's because we all still need to be fed and we need to be ordering our toilet paper and all the rest of it. And so those emissions are really relative only to the passenger auto sector. And I think that's largely true around the world. Even airplane emissions are still relatively high, with a lot of planes flying around the world with very few passengers in them. And of course, freight, et cetera, that is still being carried around the globe.
And so did you want to speak about the lived experience in large cities like Los Angeles? Because I think many people around the world, as you mentioned before, are seeing a different way of experiencing nature and of envisioning life with fewer emissions. Is that an exaggerated impression that people have, or is it not a reality?
It's a great question, and the answer is both in Los Angeles. And so I want to talk about Los Angeles, and then I want to talk about a little bit about some other cities around the world. There is no question that the air quality in late March and early April in Los Angeles was stunning. If any of you got up high hiking, my experience was that from Griffith Park, you could see the equipment at the ports in Los Angeles, not just the coast, not just Catalina, which is actually not that unusual to see. I don't think I've ever experienced days that were quite so clear. On the other hand, March and April are always beautiful months in Los Angeles. We get a lot of rain. Apologize if you can hear my little dog barking. Just started. We get a lot of rain. It clears out a lot of the particulate matter and so forth. And so it's one of the things that fries me a bit about the news coverage is that some of the headlines can actually be quite misleading. So my favorite was a CNN headline pointed out to me by one of my colleagues that said something like, "Notoriously polluted Los Angeles has some of the cleanest skies in the world right now." And the reason I bristle against that is because Los Angeles is no longer notoriously polluted. It has pollution problems, and I don't want to diminish those, but we have cleaned up our air to such a phenomenal degree that the entire county of Los Angeles in 2018 experienced only one ozone violation. The entire basin experienced only 9 particulate matter violations, and one of those was the 4th of July. We are in compliance with standards for carbon monoxide, for lead, for nitrogen dioxide, for sulfur dioxide. And those are extraordinary accomplishments that should not be diminished. And I think these headlines sometimes perpetuate a myth that Los Angeles is a cesspool, essentially. And that's just not true. Again, also, I think the headlines don't credit the time of year. And so one of the things that's going to be really interesting to see is, what does the air quality look like even if we're still shut down? You know, right now we're experiencing 90 degree days in Los Angeles. Ozone pollution tends to rise when it's hot. if we get into the summer months and we're still shut down, are we going to see those sorts of pollution improvements? Not clear. And again, this is where the truck traffic really matters, because the biggest remaining source of pollution in Los Angeles is from diesel pollution. It's not from cars anymore, although old cars can be a big problem and can be big polluters, and they may largely be off the roads, although I don't think we know the sort of content of who is still driving. So whether late March, early April was an interesting blip, or whether it's a more pronounced phenomenon as we continue to stay in our homes and don't drive a lot, I think remains to be seen. It does, though, present a really, there's no question that people have experienced what it can be like to have really, really super clean air. And if they associate it with traditional pollution sources, that can be a real positive, because I think as a political matter, people understand that that all our driving creates pollution, and gives us a real opportunity to envision a future going forward. I can say more about that, I think, when we talk about kind of longer lasting effects of the pandemic. I do want to point out a couple of other things, and that is, you may have seen pictures of Indian cities, and in particular, we've seen two, one of New Delhi with the famous gate with blue skies behind it. Another is pictures of the Himalayas, which are visible from Indian cities in ways that they haven't been in years. And what we're seeing in India is a little different than what we're seeing here. India is still fueled. A lot of their electricity comes from coal. Apparently coal use is down by about 25% right now in India. And that makes it, and then when you take driving, if you go to India and you drive around in the streets, there are a lot of polluting cars. They tend to be older. They're still equipped with catalytic converters largely, but they are polluting. You can breathe it in when you're sitting in traffic in heavily trafficked cities in India. And so the reductions in air pollutants there, I think, really are profound. Whether that matters politically in India, I have no expertise on that question, but it is really, really striking and notable. I suspect that some of the Chinese cities have experienced some similar sorts of declines as people were locked down and coal usage declined. I mean, as William already said, emissions, greenhouse gas emissions were down 25%. That had to come, a lot of that had to come from the power sector. So little brief on LA air pollution. I do just want to stress again how important it is to understand how much we've already accomplished in cleaning up our air, because I think that's a story that doesn't get told enough and is important to understand that we really can have great environmental successes through steady, competent political leadership and great scientific expertise being led to the problem.
So just to pick up a thread that I think goes through William's comments and also yours just now, one of the dynamic effects of COVID that we have to account for when we look forward is deregulatory reactions to COVID, which I can easily imagine a good faith defense of such deregulation on the grounds that, well, some emissions are down and economic hardship is up. And so at least in the short term, that trade-off maybe cuts in favor of less regulation today, assuming that whatever regulation we had before was the right amount, we should have less regulation today for the reasons I just indicated. And that I guess will cause a spike in emissions going forward. Because to William's point, I think it also relates to a lot of the political effects that you mentioned, Anne, and also the continued development of certain power sources in Asia and elsewhere. Would either of you, maybe William first, like to comment on what in fact have we seen in terms of regulatory reactions or deregulatory reactions? And then we can talk maybe a little bit more about, maybe in the same breath, about what we should think about those events.
Sure. I would just want to add one thing to what Anne was saying before too, on the remarkable progress that Los Angeles has made in cleaning up its air, and would promote her book project that is underway, well underway, and that will be hopefully coming out soon on how Los Angeles cleaned up its air. So I think we're all excited to see that. But of course, climate change and the wildfire risk in California obviously could pose some real challenges to maintaining that progress going forward, as is the case in many other parts of the Western United States. And so particulate matter pollution seems to be going back up since 2016, largely because of fires in the West. And that is obviously something to keep an eye on as we move into a time of more climate disruption.
Interrupt you there, William, too, sure. To add that ozone pollution also goes up as temperatures increase. So the interaction of climate change and air pollution is a real and problematic one that will make it harder and harder for us to maintain our air quality and to improve it.
On the rollbacks, I mean, there's a lot to talk about here, and there's obviously ongoing kind of deregulatory efforts that sort of precede the pandemic, and those that seem to be maybe accelerating a bit. I'll just mention a couple of things, and I know Anne has a lot to add here, but you know, the efforts to sort of prop up the coal industry have taken various different there have been various different efforts across the government to prop up the coal industry under the Clean Air Act in particular, through the rollback of the Clean Power Plan, the mercury air toxic standard, the sort of going after the legal basis of that, which we just saw this week. There have been efforts to delay some of the revisions of the NAAQS standards, the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. There have been efforts to roll back the regulations for water pollution from coal plants and coal ash residuals. There have been efforts at the Department of Energy and FERC to prop up the coal industry in various ways by changing the way pricing is done in some of the electricity markets. There's an ongoing effort to relax enforcement and permitting requirements during the pandemic. But I think, in my view, the biggest kind of problem that we face here in terms of the overall integrity of our environmental regulatory system at the federal level is the effort to undermine the scientific infrastructure supporting the agency's regulatory mission, which has been going on, I think, from the very beginning of the Trump administration. Senior scientists obviously are leaving the agency, as are senior career lawyers and other longtime civil servants. There has been a dismantling or a changing of the role and composition of various scientific advisory boards. The agency is changing the way they conduct risk assessment and cost-benefit analyses. And there's an effort to push ahead with the controversial transparency in science or secret science rulemaking, which require essentially that all the data underlying many public health regulations be made publicly available, which means that most public health and medical studies involving actual people that require the data to be protected and kept confidential could not be used. And this is intended to be retroactive, and really, in many respects, it's an attempt to preclude the use of certain landmark studies, such as the famous 1994 Harvard Six Cities studies that demonstrated a strong link between exposure to fine particulates and premature mortality, which has been a major engine of rulemakings under the Clean Air Act. I it's hard to know if the coronavirus pandemic will change the way we view experts and expertise. I do think that there is some reason for hope that coming out of this, we will value expertise and expert judgment and evidence-based regulation more seriously, perhaps, than some folks in the United States have over the last 4 or 5 years. But it's quite possible we could end up just as polarized, if not more polarized, than before. And so the backlash against expertise, it seems to me, is already happening in some respects. And it's hard to know how all of that will play out. And I guess we'll have to wait and see with the election and beyond. I do think that the effort to prop up the coal industry is really just it's doomed for a whole bunch of reasons. And I think the pandemic really accelerates the death of the coal industry. And so in the United States, coal-fired electricity is declining faster now after the pandemic than it was before. And so because of bad economics and because of the overall decline in electricity demand, which is roughly 5 to 15% across the country, depending on where you are, coal share of U.S. electricity is expected to be down another 20% in 2020. And so despite the Trump administration's efforts to prop up coal, it's not going to work. Coal is now down to around 16% of U.S. electricity generation, which is a stunning decline from where it has been through most of the post-World War II period, when it was well over 50% for most of that time. The last permit for a new coal-fired power plant was denied in Georgia 2 weeks ago, and I think we can expect to see early retirements, an acceleration of early retirements of existing plants around the country. And I think from an air quality standpoint and from a greenhouse gas standpoint, that is clearly positive. There are jobs, though, in communities that are suffering because of this. And I think that goes to your point, Richard. There could be an effort to prop up the coal industry around the rationale that this is really going to protect jobs. But there's, in the United States, only about 50,000 jobs in coal mining. And that's about a fifth of the number of jobs in solar in the United States. And it seems to me we absolutely have to find ways to create meaningful opportunities for displaced workers in a new clean energy economy. But I don't know that it's the best use of our sort of time, effort, and taxpayer dollars to really try to support an industry that, from an economic standpoint, is really not going to survive. I could say more about the oil industry as well, but maybe I'll hold off and see if Ann has a tad and maybe come back to that.
Yeah, do you want to jump in, Ann?
Sure, I want to jump in a couple of different ways. So your question is really moving forward, right? Does this present an opportunity to advance deregulatory, anti-regulatory efforts? What William concentrated on was what has been an assault on the regulatory state since Trump took office. I should disclose that I'm not a fan of that assault, and I've intervened in several cases as an amicus or as a lawyer representing parties on a number of these issues, just in the interest of full disclosure. William has as well. So you know where I'm coming from. I think that's a fair disclosure. I want to concentrate on so going forward, I think there's a really interesting question. Is it going to be deregulatory or is it going to be re-regulatory? Probably not with this president, but for example, maybe an obvious point, but in the middle of a respiratory pandemic, do we want to return to dirtier air? It just seems like a basic political question that's a pretty powerful one. And, you know, particularly when people are experiencing the effects of very clean air, that's actually healthy for all of us and we can feel it. And I think regulations where the public actually understands their effect are often very politically popular. So, you know, you could flip that question, but we are seeing even in the pandemic, some anti-regulatory moves using the pandemic, I think, as an excuse. One is one that William mentioned, that is an enforcement letter that was sent by EPA to regulated parties. This was, as I understand it, at the behest of the American Petroleum Institute. It basically mirrored a request that API had made several days earlier to essentially suspend routine monitoring and enforcement if a company had a COVID-related excuse. And the biggest problem, as I see with the guidance, is that there's no definition of what that means. You could drive a truck through it. It's a very, very big loophole. So there's essentially a sort of suspension of enforcement at the same time that the New York Times is reporting that EPA staff are being heavily, heavily pressured to continue to get rules that roll back Obama-era standards out before a new Congress comes in. There's a complicated congressional review procedure that allows Congress to repeal newly adopted regulations within 60 days. And so there's a big rush right now to get a lot of rules in. So you can see the message. The message is deregulate and use your staff to do that during a pandemic when people are at home, working at home, with all the challenges that that brings. And at the same time, we're going to relax enforcement because, after all, people are at home facing challenges, et cetera. So I think the other place we see it is, as I understand it, virtually no enforcement of OSHA, indoor environmental issue that many of us environmentalists don't pay enough attention to. But obviously we have workers, essential workers across the country facing very harrowing circumstances because of the virus. But it's not the only circumstance that we might want to worry about if you relax OSHA enforcement. And then I want to turn to the rollback of the CAR standards, which has happened during the pandemic and has gotten a lot of attention, I think is worth focusing on, particularly in light of William's comments about the job losses in the coal industry. So just for a little history, Trump campaigned in Michigan on rolling back, essentially doing away with standards that were adopted during the Obama administration to significantly increase fuel economy and reduce greenhouse gas emissions coming out of the tailpipes and other parts of automobiles. California was in alignment with the federal standards. California has its own special authority to issue those standards. It basically intertwined its standards with the federal government, but was also granted a waiver to move forward in the event that the federal government did not do so. Prior to the pandemic, the Trump administration revoked the California waiver. That's the subject of a lot of litigation right now. And during the pandemic, came through with its threat to roll back the standards, although it didn't roll them back as far as it had initially had proposed, in part because the administrative record it had created was so full of flaws that the math couldn't justify the proposal that the administration was pushing. So instead of freezing standards at 2021 levels, they are essentially taking what was a 5% cut each year and cutting it back to about 1.5%. The auto industry itself says that it is going to gain more in fuel efficiency and in greenhouse gas emissions reductions than is actually required by the standards. But here's the really the most ironic part. The most ironic part is that in the regulatory documents submitted by the Trump administration itself, they acknowledge job losses of about 13,500 jobs per year as a result of the rollback of the regulations. So this is not a job creating bill. This is an oil promoting regulation. There are also acknowledgments that we will see increases in deaths from exposure to fine particulate matter and other pollutants as a result of the rollback of the standards. So the anti-regulatory move is ongoing and continues. And you know, will we see it accelerate? I think you know, November 2020 really kind of is the answer to that question. If Trump stays in office, yes, it will continue and maybe accelerate. If he's defeated, I think we'll see a wholesale reversal of a lot of what's been going on.
So I want to take up William's invitation for him to talk a little bit more about other sectors of the economy and energy sectors. But maybe one small comment I kind of make to maybe inflect the remarks that either of you make next. I thought one interesting comment that William made, if I understood it, was partly about how COVID is having unanticipated second order economic effects, in the sense that lots of businesses and ways of doing things that maybe they were already in a precarious position, maybe they were doing well before, but the whole competitive environment is just totally different after COVID. It's obviously different in the short term, and it's going to be structurally changed in the medium and long terms going forward. And I wonder if either of you would like to remark on that kind of dynamic, specifically with respect to different components of energy markets, and maybe also with respect to governments, because different governments are going to be more or less fiscally sound after this in ways that were not foreseeable perhaps beforehand. And there are going to be new winners and new losers for a whole host of reasons. And I think all of those dynamics will have to affect energy policy and environmental policy too. So, William, should we start with you? Maybe you can take up none of the things I just said, or maybe some of them, or whatever. No, you sure.
So I'll say a couple things, and I'll stay focused on energy. I do think there's a much broader set of issues here about how supply chains are reorganizing, how companies are paying attention to redundancy and resiliency in their own supply chains, and to what that means for the global economy. But in terms of energy, I mean, I've said a bit about coal already. I think it's fair to say that, you know, just as a conclusion, that coal is dying faster in the United States than it was before. I think natural gas is holding its own. Natural gas prices are down, and natural gas has certainly suffered a bit, but we're not seeing the same level of demand destruction with natural gas that we saw that we're seeing in the oil industry, because there's not as direct link to transportation. Most gas in the United States, natural gas, is used for electricity generation, for heating and cooking, commercial and industrial operations. And about 40% of natural gas production in the United States is so-called associated gas, that is, it's produced as a byproduct of oil production. So as oil production declines in the United States, gas production also declines. And so analysts are expecting that natural gas generation in the United States, that is the share of natural gas in the electricity sector, will roughly be kind of flat going forward, and that natural gas prices might actually start to increase from what have been historic lows for some time now because of the shale gas boom. And so I don't expect to see kind of huge changes in the natural gas markets, at least certainly not compared to oil. The oil markets obviously have been all over the news over the last week, and there's been all kinds of volatility. Global demand for oil seems to be down, you know, about 20%, about 20 million barrels per day, and it may be expected to drop to 30 million barrels a day, or 30%. And that has obviously then led to a price collapse. Prices for physical oil in the U.S. are in the single digits. The West Texas Intermediate futures contract for May delivery closed at negative $37 and change on Monday, as many people probably saw in the news, which essentially means that sellers had to pay buyers $38 per barrel to take their oil, or that those who had bought the contract had to pay a counterparty $38 to close out the contract and avoid taking the oil. And this is being driven largely because there's no storage. And so the expectations are that the kind of global storage capacity for oil is saturated or will be saturated in the next few weeks. And you've got oil super tankers that are filling up and basically roaming the high seas, waiting for prices to go back up and looking for an opportunity. The big picture here is that we've passed peak oil. That is that the global oil production peaked in 2019, and we are now on a long-term secular decline of oil production globally. Some were projecting that that would happen in 2023, but most analysts, I think, agree that now COVID has pushed that or brought that forward. And so going forward, the real question is what happens next and what does the slope of that curve of oil production decline look like and how quickly can we transition to a low carbon economy? It's not hard to see. It seems to me that we have an historic opportunity here to accelerate the move to electric vehicles and to electrify other parts of the economy. I think the large oil companies and the large OPEC producers all know that this is coming. Many of them are trying to manage the transition on their own terms. And I think this will be one of the real battles coming out of the pandemic. Just say a couple things about renewables and then turn it over to Anne. I mean, renewables are also suffering in the short term, but not nearly as much as oil and coal. And I think they're doing better overall than natural gas. And so I think renewable energy actually comes out of the pandemic in a stronger relative position, but there is obviously some pain in the short term. Renewable energy finance has slowed as capital markets have seized up. Projects have been delayed or abandoned. Supply chains have been disrupted. Jobs are being lost. One recent survey found that I think 80% of clean energy companies have stopped or delayed previously announced projects. Demand for tax credits, which are big support for renewable energy, has all but dried up, leading clean energy advocates to push for some changes to tax credit provisions, including extensions of deadlines and moving to cash grants that are similar to what happened after the 2008 financial crisis. Job losses in the clean energy sector are roughly 100,000 or so right now, but the expectations are that we could lose 500,000 workers in the clean energy sector during the course of the pandemic, and that's about 15% of the clean energy workforce. But overall, renewable energy, wind and solar in particular, are expected to grow, continue growing as a share of U.S. electricity generation. And wind and solar capacity additions are expected to be down overall for 2020 by about 5 and 10% respectively. And so I think the expectation is that renewable energy will grow by 10 or 15% in terms of the overall share of U.S. electricity. That is, it will grow by 10 or 15% in 2020. That's compared to a 20% drop for coal and a roughly flat to no growth for natural gas. All of that has implications for jobs, obviously, and I think a lot of it has implications for how we think about a green stimulus and a jobs program, things like that, if that becomes a big part of the conversation about the recovery coming out of the pandemic. But I'll pause and see if Anne has anything to say, and maybe we can come back to that.
Yeah, so if I just before you jump in, Anne, if I could just say, because we have a little over 10 minutes left, I want to get to some questions. Maybe we could, I just throw into the long list of things for on the agenda for you to answer now. Maybe we could transition a little bit to the question of broader lessons for global warming and other forms of environmental concern, broader lessons and legacy effects we could see associated with COVID.
Sure. Let me just start, though, by saying that one thing to watch, I think, is what happens to the auto sector. With huge declines in oil prices, obviously a freeze right now on manufacturing, a lot of uncertainty about whether the rules that the Trump administration has adopted are actually going to go into effect. Big changes in the way that consumers may evaluate the purchase of cars. I think it's going to be really difficult to figure out going forward what are cars going to look like, what are purchasing decisions going to look like. Is the decline in gas prices going to lead to an increase in SUV purchases, gas-guzzling cars, et cetera? So that's one thing to watch. The other thing to watch is whether some manufacturing comes back to the United States. I do think one of the lessons of the supply chain debacle with the COVID supplies is that we may want to have better control over our supply chains. And I don't know whether that's a legacy effect on the manufacturing side. Moving forward, thinking about policy, because I think this is going to be both a very painful time for climate policy and for government spending more generally, and also may provide some opportunities. So let me just say a little bit about that. I think the pain is obvious. So for example, in California's cap and trade market, allowance prices are down. We have some mechanisms to prop those prices up, but if you have big declines in greenhouse gases that are coming not from structural changes in behavior, but instead from reduced demand, prices are going to plummet. That has effects not just for the allowance market, but also because we raise a lot of revenue through our cap and trade program, and that revenue gets used to spend on green energy programs, green infrastructure, and so forth. And more generally, we're going to see a huge decline in state revenues. I don't think there's any question about that. And that's going to be, I think, going to make the appetite for spending on green projects, et cetera, potentially a lot lower. Certainly the federal level, you know, we're seeing all kinds of money come out. I guess the big question would be, can you structure some of the stimulus money that is inevitably coming out, that's not just for hospitals and to make universities whole and so forth, but more generally to try to stimulate the economy? Can it be structured to meet some of the goals of the Green New Deal? I mean, this seems like a perfect opportunity to be thinking about green infrastructure. It creates jobs and has the added benefit of potentially building lasting change in the way that our infrastructure looks over the course of the next 30 or 40 years. We saw some of that in the 2009 Recovery Act. The state of California itself could use some stimulus money for various green sort of projects and jobs. And so I think that as terrible as the COVID epidemic is in every respect, including government finances, we may have an opportunity to think more creatively about stimulus money and other policies moving forward, keeping in mind, you know, William's admonition at the beginning that even with the slowdown in economic activity and the stay home orders, we aren't close to cutting greenhouse gases enough to meet the 1.5 degree or even 2 degree centigrade goal set forth in the Paris Agreement.
William, if you want to jump in, that'd be fine. Or we could take our first question from our large and very eager audience.
Just very briefly, I'll say two quick points, Richard. I mean, number one, I mean, I think the real question here is, you know, does the pandemic crowd out climate action? And that is, does it promote the idea that we need to wait until the economy recovers and we get back to business as usual before we get serious about climate action? And I just don't think we have the luxury to do that. That's in some ways what we did after the financial crisis, not entirely. But I do think at this point, right, given where we are with the climate emergency, given the fact that the stakes are higher with the climate emergency, we really need to seize the opportunity to rebuild our economies in a way that will promote and accelerate the clean energy transition. And I think in the United States, that means decarbonizing electricity faster. And I think California has been a real leader and a model for that. And then electrifying transportation and other sectors as quickly as we can, which then brings in all these infrastructure projects and the build out of infrastructure that Anne was talking about, which ought to be, it seems to me, an opportunity for jobs, for significant jobs. And so you can imagine a way in which this combines with a jobs program. And a lot of people are talking about this as part of a green stimulus. The other piece of this is what the central banks are doing. And so there has been some talk before the crisis, I think, around how central banks could use their enormous influence over monetary policy to really move or start to green the way in which capital moves around the economy. That is to start to channel capital and require banks to channel capital into more green and climate-friendly pursuits. And it seems to me now is an opportune time to accelerate those conversations and try to coordinate them more on a global scale. So I'll stop there because I know there are a lot of questions. And
great. Well, I especially appreciated the point William made about whether the COVID crisis pandemic will be a substitute for environmental action or a spur into greater environmental action. So let me say two quick questions from our chat room here. So one is a student question, and the question is basically, are we seeing any increased rates of COVID-19 diagnoses or hospitalizations in frontline communities already hit hardest by air pollution? And then the question goes on to talk about disparities in testing and whether those kinds of environmental and community disparities may not be observed, and whether they might be a larger part of a larger political conversation of COVID reactions and also environmental regulation. And since we're well on time, let's start another question that was asked in the chat box as well, that I think is actually related and related to a number of things that you both have been saying, Anne and William. And that is the question about how to dissolve political opposition to environmental regulation by dissolving the supposed opposition between the economic well-being of the country or of the world and environmental well-being. I think those are linked in part because they're both about prescriptions for how the political and social ramifications of COVID reaction could be channeled in a productive way for environmental regulation. Anne, do you want to take a stab at either of those questions?
Sure. So I don't think we know yet enough about the relationship between COVID and air pollution, but we do know it's a respiratory disease, and we know that people with respiratory problems are getting hit harder by the disease. Smoking certainly is a problem. Vaping, it appears, may be a problem in young people and their reaction to the virus. And so it's not a stretch at all to think that air pollution is a big and exacerbating effect. What I think we don't know is term exposure versus long-term exposure. Do we get some benefit right now from the fact that the air is cleaner as a result of slowing the economy and our response, our bodily responses to COVID? I don't think we know the answer to that question yet. On the political point, you know, this is always a hard tension that I think is a false dichotomy. And I hope, William already said one thing, which is that one would hope that if we take nothing else out from this COVID epidemic, it's that good government matters, and science matters, and scientific expertise matters, and it makes us better off when we rely on scientists and expertise, and we have good and effective government. Boy, if that lesson doesn't come through, I don't know how else we could possibly make it. But, you know, just a couple of other observations back to Los Angeles and its clean air. You know, Los Angeles has had some of the most stringent environmental standards in the world, particularly with respect to air pollution, for many, many, many years, beginning in the 1940s. And we are booming. We have a huge and vibrant economy. In fact, the Chamber of Commerce led a lot of the early action to reduce air pollution because people didn't want to move here. They didn't want to live here because the air quality was so bad. So, you know, you could, to some degree, think that the economic expansion in Los Angeles is related to our cleanup of our air. So also just go back to the car standards again. The tightening of the car standards actually increases jobs. It doesn't decrease it. And that's sometimes there are consequences to jobs. There are real job losses from environmental regulation. I don't want to minimize them. William talked about them in the context of coal, but boy, do I think it gets overstated. And one more thing, you know, the California economy has outpaced the rest of the country pre-pandemic. And a big chunk of that is because of venture capital being invested in green technology. We have stringent climate policies. We also have innovation as a result. And it's been one of our great competitive advantages is to lead in the development of environmental technology. That's job creating. It's not an accident that we environmental businesses, technology companies, supporting stringent California climate policy because it's an opportunity to develop technology, battery technology for cars, storage capacity for the electricity grid, renewable energy with, you know, prices declining dramatically as we scale up and so forth. And so the dichotomy, I guess, is always frustrating to me. And I'm hoping that, that these examples are ways of demonstrating that it is not mutually exclusive to regulate the environment strongly and also produce good and clean jobs.
Do you want to add anything to that, William?
Very briefly, I'll just say that, you know, that all of the structural vulnerabilities that make climate change so dangerous for poor frontline communities are obviously all over the world are being compounded and amplified by coronavirus. I have seen some suggestions that there's a link between coronavirus mortality rates and air pollution. And there are real concerns, as I mentioned at the beginning, in Brazil, for example, that as they move into the fire season and air quality deteriorates, just as the coronavirus infection rate is peaking over the course of the summer, they're going to see increases in mortality. So I think it's absolutely right on that we need to be thinking long and hard about the vulnerabilities around the world and the fact that climate change just pounds away year after year on these frontline communities. And so, you know, putting them at the very center of a strategy for rebuilding is critical. On the political point too, I mean, to me, I think we're better off taking this out of the context of environmental regulation and environmental law and thinking about it in the context of building new clean energy economies, of thinking about it in the context of infrastructure investment and jobs. And so I think, you know, every time we're back in the world of talking about this as whether environmental regulations are destroying jobs or creating jobs and sort of whether they're over-regulating or under-regulating, we're already kind of in the wrong frame, in my view. I think we're seeing secular transitions in the electricity industry. The energy transition is underway. It's happening. Now the question is, can we accelerate it and use this opportunity to drive it faster and to create good long-term jobs in the process?
Great. So I'll just give a last couple. We're basically at time. I think, do you two have time for one more round of questions? Great. Okay. So I'll try to package a number of questions and then add one last question and offer it to you all. And then that can be our last round of conversation. So there have been a number of questions in the chat that from various directions have asked about, I think more detail and you both have talked about it to some extent, but more detail about how oil prices fluctuating downward and the economic adverse economic effects for the energy sector, how will those effects play out? And so one line of chat questions is talking about, well, does this make these sectors of the economy more subject to nationalization or beneficent purchase by kind of super wealthy individuals who might pursue a certain publicly interested in, environmental policy? And there's another line in the chats that suggests that these exact same phenomena of kind of business vulnerability for these sectors of the economy could lead to, as we've discussed to some extent, could lead to greater governmental solicitousness and could actually lead to an entrenchment of those economic actors and indeed to greater pollution in the not even long term, but in the medium term. And so that's one kind of package of questions I'm kind of going to put forward under that heading. And then there's a final question here that just came in, which I think can be conveyed, which has to do with whether COVID, partly through its direct effects and partly due to its effects on energy, might alter transit systems in cities in ways that could have long-term structural effects. So that's the last question for me, and then I'll leave it to the two of you to take us home here.
Great. Let me start with the transit question because I think it highlights different directions we could go. So you could imagine stimulus money being used to invest. This is the green infrastructure question, right? If you know, right now we face it, you know, we could spend a bunch of money building highways, or we could beef up our transit systems. And the choice we make with stimulus dollars that I think are going to be flowing from the federal government and potentially from the state government could have enormous consequences, not just for the short term, but for the medium term. And so this is the sort of Green New Deal push, and this is the time, it feels, to be asking those questions and to be really trying to formulate policy in a way that isn't just about, you know, spending the money as quickly as we can, but thinking about what it means for the next 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years. Electric vehicle infrastructure is another possibility. California actually has some money from the VW settlement that it's been investing, which is great, but some of it also comes from cap and trade revenue. Again, that revenue is declining, so we're gonna need to find some substitute sources to spend. Obviously, Los Angeles has been investing heavily in its public transit system. You know, we could do more and we could do it faster with more money. And again, that's a great jobs creator. Although of course, how we work in some of these environments and maintain some of the physical distancing that's gonna be required is also gonna be challenging over the course of the next year or more as we adjust to trying to figure out how to keep ourselves safe and not sick and keep the curve as flat as we can and so forth. I'll turn it over to William now.
Yeah, so just to wrap things up, I mean, on the nationalization question, I guess if that's a question about whether or not in the United States the government is going to nationalize the oil industry, I don't see any indication that that would happen, although I do think there are some efforts to bail out the shale oil industry a bit, but I don't think they're going to work, although the president this week did direct the Treasury Secretary to develop a plan to help the oil industry here in the United States. But the shale oil industry in the United States was already in big trouble. The break-even price for a barrel of oil for shale producers in the United States is about $55 a barrel, and we're nowhere close to that and won't be for some time. And there was already a huge increase in bankruptcies across that sector before the pandemic, and those will accelerate. There is an effort to prop up the corporate debt markets, and the Federal Reserve is doing some of that, and these shale companies do have quite a bit of high-yield debt that has been financing the shale boom. I think that is not going to be enough. And we'll see what the president comes back with or the Treasury comes back with in terms of their efforts to prop up the oil industry. But I think it's really a moment to think about kind of what does our addiction to oil look like coming out of this? And I think that goes to transportation and to the question about alternative designs of our cities and more transit-oriented designs and obviously electrification of the vehicle fleet. There's a whole bunch of nitty-gritty questions about what that should look like and how to do that. But I think it is a moment of opportunity to really try to shift that and to move away from oil on our own terms and not necessarily the terms of the oil industry. So I'll stop there and just want to thank you, Richard, for everything and thank everyone for participating.
Yeah, can I just add one thing to what William said? On top of all of that, though, cheap oil prices often lead to more consumption. And I think we can't ignore that. I think it's a reality. I think it changes how consumers make vehicle purchases. It changes how much we drive. And so I worry that the giant decline in oil prices has some consequences that are gonna be very hard to overcome, even with pretty stringent government. And we gotta think hard about how to overcome that. You know, taxation is gonna be really tough in the next several years as we try to recover economically. And so I don't have great answers, but I think those are questions that we need to be asking and really focused on. And thank you, everyone. Thank you, Richard. Really appreciate it. It was a great conversation.
Well, thank you both very much. I want to thank William and Anne again for joining us in this conversation. Thank you to the audience. This video and audio will be posted at the website for the UCLA Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy, which I see as a question that was just raised. And I look forward to having more conversations and to learning more about this important issue from both of you and indeed from many members of our audience later on. Thank you again. Stay safe, everyone.
And I think we'll post it on the Emmett Institute website as well. So Great. You can find it in two different places.
Great. Thank you,
everyone.
Stay safe. Thanks,
care.
Everyone.
Stay safe. Be healthy.